This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Thursday, time to talk about all things municipal. And we'll break down a raft of revelations about what the City of Toronto, under John Tory, agreed to in order to snag six FIFA World Cup games. And by the way, they are not the most consequential games in the season. So when the tournament comes to town in 2026, Toronto will be required to make changes from everything from its transportation to public spaces to tax policy to who it does business with. And in addition, there'll be tax exemptions, free advertising space, and a commitment to police the skies to make sure that FIFA's brand is protected and no one puts up that logo that hasn't paid for it. Now, Olivia Chow, the mayor, is pledging, quote, financial success for the World Cup. And the World Cup's cost has ballooned from an original estimate of just $45 million on the high end to $380 million. Chow has appointed a World Cup czar to keep a lid on costs. That's former budget chief David Sucknacki. The bottom line is that, quote, we don't know how much lunch will cost tomorrow. And we'll also get to revelations about the plan for Ontario Place and complaints to 311. We want to hear from you as well. 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740.
And now, it's time to tune into the town.
And now I'd like to welcome Councillor Paula Fletcher, Ward 14, Toronto Danforth, Councillor James Pasternak, Ward 6, York Centre, and Taylor Scanlon, co-founder of The Peak. Sorry, that was a sneeze that didn't quite happen.
Bless you, Libby.
Thank you. Blessing me in advance. I want to start with a subject that I start every day hoping I will not have to cover, and that is mushrooming anti-Semitic incidents. The latest targeting James Pasternak, who is one of our panelists today and who received hateful, threatening, anti-Semitic phone messages in his office, and a 64-year-old man has been charged. Hi to all of you, and James, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, look, like every counselor, we pull off our messages on a daily basis from our voicemail, and we were shocked and saddened to hear this profanity-laced, hate-filled message with horrible things being said, hateful things. And threatening things, and we, as with any hate crime that we are made aware of or see, we pass it on to police, and in their judgment, it met the threshold of charges.
And what about your staff? What's do they feel okay?
Yeah. So when you hear something like that, when someone is shouting into your voicemail such hateful things. It is upsetting to hear that kind of language and hate, but they've been okay. I mean, they continue to work, and we had a security check around our constituency office, and we were in touch with police, and you know, we soldier on. We can't be intimidated by angry mobs.
Okay. Yeah. And well. Lots of politicians have been targeted, especially women politicians. And in terms of anti-Semitic incidents, Deputy Conservative Leader Melissa Lansman, her office was vandalized within the last month. I can't remember exactly. But moving right along, to the matter at hand, I'm looking at Taylor Scullin. What do you make of these revelations about what Toronto agreed to get those games?
Well, when I read the story, my first thought was I'd love to be FIFA because they've got a great thing going here where they seem to take all the revenue and shoulder very little of the cost. But, you know, the exact terms, I thought there was nothing more shocking in those than really exceeded the sticker price of this thing of $380 million. I think the bigger issue here is that we really need to open up the processes that lead to these decisions. If the public is going to be on the hook for hundreds of millions of dollars, we should have an insight into how these negotiations are going, what we're offering, what we're getting much earlier in the process than we have in this case, because clearly we're not getting a good deal out of it.
Well, yeah. And Olivia Chow, the mayor, says it's going to be transparent. But the fact is, when dealing with organizations like FIFA, which I think is pretty corrupt, but it holds all the cards, you have to apparently agree to those things if you want the games. And if you don't agree to them, you won't get the games. Paula Fletcher.
Yeah, Libby, you're right. They hold all the cards, and I guess they're pretty canny negotiators. So I agree with Taylor. How did we get this far and not know about it? And thank you to the crusading journalism of one Ben Spur. We know that there was a decision point in June of 2022 where something should have been brought to council to say, here's where we're at. No support here, no support there. Here's the things they want. Do you want to proceed? And there was a decision, I gather, by the mayor and then city manager not to do that. So I kind of feel on this one, I feel pretty much like a mushroom up until we started getting this information. The other thing is, I think people should know that the Auditor General in the city, who has very wide scope to investigate, she said she's putting the FIFA on her work plan. So we're going to know a lot more, but it will be, the barn door has been closed. The horse is out of the barn, so we'll only know what happened. We won't be able to correct anything going forward.
Okay, yes. It seems that every day we find out more and more about this. The other thing that I question, so we always see these economic impact statements, and this one, I believe, I'm just looking, they're saying 3,600 jobs and $393 million in local GDP. But James Pasternak, we know that of the tax revenue generated by this, we are only going to get the crumbs.
Yeah, well, I'm surprised people are surprised, because whenever you start negotiations with one of these major international organizations that bring either sports or cultural events to your city, like the Olympic Games or FIFA, or of course international exhibitions, you have very little bargaining power as a city, and because there's six other cities that will take it if you don't. And they set the rules, and what you have to do is try and maneuver your local economy to make sure you maximize it. In our situation, hotels, restaurants, confectionery, those are kind of the areas where it's an economic boost to our city. The other thing is the intangibles, such as our city will be on the world stage, and that is advertising that money cannot buy. And I think, you know, the other thing is, are we ready for prime time? This is a city that has never hosted an Olympic Games, never hosted an international exhibition, never hosted a Commonwealth Games, and I think it's long overdue. We did host the Pan Am Games. Yes, Pan Am Games was amazing. I went to some of the events. It changed the city for the positive. It left legacy infrastructure in sports and culture. And, of course, it was a great thing for the city as a whole. So I would say that if you're going to host some of these international events, be prepared to sign a bad deal. And that's exactly what we got.
Well, as to us never having hosted an Olympics, I say amen to that. And
yeah,
let's hope
God.
We never do, because that would be even more of a disaster. I grew up in Montreal, the place where you could no more lose money on an Olympic Games than a man could have a baby. That was before a lot of advances in reproductive technology. So, yeah. It's one of the things that I also want to challenge. This is one of the things people say. It's going to be so good for our city. It's really going to put us on the map. Now, Saudi Arabia just hosted, I forget which, very large sporting event. I have a hunch that tourism to Saudi Arabia did not go huge because of that, Taylor.
Yeah, you know, I went back and looked at some of the past hosts of the World Cup just to see what the experience was like for them. And I could only find one example of it ending up being a net positive for the city, and that was Barcelona. And, you know, I think it's been good for them. Tourism has gone up a lot in Barcelona, maybe because of that, maybe because of other reasons. But
yeah, frankly, they tend to win World Cups.
Well, I'm sure that helps. You know, never say never. Canada might have a shot. But, you know, I think we have a lot of other issues that need to be dealt with here. And that's going to be, you know, having garbage picked up off the streets, having potholes filled, having housing for people that they can afford would be much more appreciated amongst regular people in this city than a few World Cup games.
Okay, I'm going to take a call from Jody in Toronto. Hello, Jody.
Hi, Libby. Libby, I'm listening to the comments from the councillors there, and I'm a little concerned. They were there when this decision was made, but listening to their comments today, it was almost like they didn't know what was going on or nothing was shared with them. And perhaps they can give us some little understanding of how these things happen, like when you're there and these decisions are made, and now they're saying, like, well, we didn't know. That's how it comes across to us. Maybe they can share some information with us.
Well, they didn't get the information. It was Freedom of Information, and it was the Toronto Star that's finding out these details. And if you'll recall, and I recall this from the election campaign, Olivia Chow said she could not get details on this. So they're pretty tight. Let's go to Lewis in Toronto. Hi, Lewis.
Hi, Libby. How are you?
I'm good. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay, and hello to everyone else.
Hi. Hello.
I wanted to talk about the FIFA. Did they ever consider the capacity of the stadium? Because I was reading that BMO, they had to put in another 5,000 feet or seats to bring it up to 45,000.
That's right.
Because they only had 40. And I was thinking, like, comparing it, like, for the money we're paying, and you're only 45,000 people can go to this thing. And I was on Wikipedia looking up capacity for stadiums all over the world. And the 40,000 is nothing compared to other major cities that have bigger stadiums. So, yeah. I don't know. I'm trying to measure the dollar amount to the amount of people that can go to this, and what's, like, how can this benefit anything?
Okay. Thank you for that. That's a very good point. Before we move along, so the way Mayor Chow is setting this up, she's totally distancing herself, and now she's got this czar, David Sucknacki, that can take her yet another step further away from this. So do you think she's set herself up the way that she's not going to wear any of this?
I would say...
Sorry, go ahead, Paula.
You know, you have to realize that you've been dealt a hand, and those are your cards. So those decisions were made, and they were made without bringing that to council about when they got into Thorny. Are we still going ahead despite not having met the conditions that were put down? But I think that making the best of a bad situation, having Deputy Mayor Cole chair one, having David Sucknacki, former councillor, budget chief, he certainly isn't a lefty. He's a very tight-fisted conservative. And then having a group looking at how can we get more revenue, because I think you'd said, you know, here's the amount to the GDP, but that doesn't mean anything coming directly to the city. So how can we make up some of the revenue that we know we're going to lose? And I think Councillor Carroll and Councillor Thompson on that. So she's trying to be thoughtful and actually make the best of a bad hand.
James, do you think she's set it up so none of this is going to end up on her?
Well, we're trying to make the best of the situation. I would say that there's two things that really shrunk council's power and the need to be kept informed of key decision-making behind closed door. And one is the shrinking of council by 19 seats back in 2008, which took away a lot of our political gravitas. And, of course, the pandemic, which the public service took over much of the decision making that would normally come to council. And unfortunately, we have to fight back to get, I know that's the show we're on, but we have to go claw back the power that we had in the past to review key documents and review key decisions. So it's true, we delegated some of this off to staff to negotiate, but it was always my feeling they would report back with what they came up with. What they did was they delegated it, and then they signed the whole deal. So,
well, that was probably a John Tory thing, but in terms of the staff, does seem to be directing the ship, and they'll only keep doing that if the council allows them to do it.
Well, we expect them to report back, but I think the team that the mayor has put together, as Councillor Fletcher said, is a very capable group. That's going to look at every possible opportunity to have a great FIFA tournament and make sure that a lot of the revenue stays in the city.
Okay. Taylor, here's another revelation involving the Ford government, but really targeting Toronto. And it looks like from a schematic that there's a plan to fill in a portion of Lake Ontario for the new development, and not clear in questioning whether that's actually what they want to do or that was one of, you know, however many proposals they had.
Yeah, I mean, it was very unclear and nebulous, this whole scheme. But, I mean, it strikes me that this is yet again another sort of backroom deal between a level of government and a private enterprise. And this is not a partisan point, because governments of all stripes are engaged in this sort of dealing. And I think it's to our detriment, really. You know, if you're raising money for a business, you go out, you put your proposal on the table with your investors, you say, this is what you're going to get back. Your cards are on the table. Everyone knows what the deal is. In this situation, the government is seemingly doing these things behind closed doors. We find out about it after the ink is dry and the deal is done. And then we say, well, there's nothing we can do about it now. I don't think that's really serving us very well.
Yeah, it's in a lot of ways a very, very similar situation. Paula Fletcher, what do you think about that? I mean, it seems to me that, again, the mayor sort of made a deal that she wasn't going to complain about anything happening at Ontario Place in exchange for a big whack of dough she got from Queen's Park.
Yeah, she said that's a provincial project, so I won't stick my nose right into it. But you've said before about different things, there's always more to come. And on this file, wow, this is a very big revelation. I agree with Taylor. It's really something. You know, to fill the lake in, that isn't just easy to do. That the permitting, the federal government controls the lake, the water, the fishing, everything. So how you got along that you're going to have a lake filling project with no approvals to have a lake filling project is the next thing we're going to have to find out.
Okay, well, maybe it doesn't happen. Maybe this government will be past its best before date long before you get those approvals. On a lot of projects, I find that the timelines for getting everything in order are just ridiculous. It doesn't happen like that, not in our city. A couple more things. So there was a list of what the complaints to 311 were, and by far the biggest complaints, the most number, were on broken bins, garbage bins, compost bins, recycling bins, 20,000 of them. And I did a couple of segments on this, actually, because I was very impressed. My husband asked for a new bin online, and it came in 3 weeks, which is like lightning speed. But getting rid of the old broken bin, forget it. That hasn't happened. So is there a better approach to dealing with bad bins, James?
Well, the first thing I would suggest to listeners is to find out when your local environment days are, and attend those. And not only can you get free mulch, you could drop off unused electronics and other goods, toxins and paints. But you can also exchange bins at those at most of those events. So environment days are a great opportunity. Each counselor does two of them for the most part. The other thing is, I guess, 311, we have to work with them to make sure that their service levels are better, and work with Solid Waste to make sure the requests for broken bins are accelerated. It's a customer service problem, and I'm glad they brought it to our attention, because I'm going to be working with Councillor Fletcher and my colleagues to see that we can do better on that file.
Okay, I'm going to take a call from Sita in Mississauga. Hi, Sita.
Hi, Libby. Thank you. Out of the frying pan into the fire again. Oh, my God. You would think that Mr. Ford by now, have learned from the past mistake, especially the green belt. And I can't believe he has more tricks to pull out of his hat by fooling in Lake Ontario for a spa that people aren't interested in. Thanks.
Okay, I think that sums up how you feel, Sita. Thanks for that. Nice and concise. And, you know, we've been talking about numbers, which I often think are kind of pulled out of a hat or trumped up. So let me bring up a couple of other numbers. And some of them came out yesterday. And those are the numbers that we've seen about how many people are going to be going to Niagara Falls or Kingston to see the eclipse, which is coming up very soon. And I talked to the mayor of Niagara Falls, Ontario, yesterday, and he said it comes from an American documentary crew that has dealt with a lot of eclipses before. It's very hard for me to imagine that a million people are going to descend on Niagara Falls, even though it is the best place to watch the eclipse. And if a million people do descend on Niagara Falls, oh my goodness.
I can't imagine anywhere I'd rather be less, Libby. Go to Hamilton.
How would you get there? And then once you got there, how would you get back?
Well, not anytime soon. That is absolutely for sure. And there are some other places that will have okay viewing. And I gave Taylor a dirty look because I don't want him disclosing.
That's right.
That. But Kingston, 500,000. I mean, I've been to big kind of government events. I remember going in Ottawa to the sesquicentennial, and it was 3 hours in line with a lot fewer people. I don't remember the number. And then when you get there, it was a big bust, bad entertainment followed by a huge rainstorm. Not to diss good public events, but James Pasternak, do you have a sense of Niagara Falls or Kingston? 500,000 people in Kingston?
Yeah, so when you have that kind of a density, that kind of numbers converging on a finite space in a short period of time, you're asking for trouble, because there's almost no city in North America can handle that intake of vehicles and people in that short window. So while it might look good on paper to have all this commerce coming in and filling your hotel rooms and your restaurants, the chaos that it causes may be diminishing returns. So I wish the best for these cities. I hope they are quite successful during the eclipse. But a cautionary tale that it could leave some bad feelings afterwards.
Yeah, but it, all of you, like, do you even believe those numbers? Again, with all of these big events, I really feel like numbers are pulled out of a hat.
There are these websites and who's going where. You know, a lot of people sign up to do something and say, oh, yeah, I'm going to go, and then they don't go. Hopefully the sun will be out that day. I'm not sure what happens on a cloudy day for an eclipse. But this is once in a lifetime. I don't think that the solar eclipse has been in this vicinity for quite a long time. And I would think not everybody's going to downtown Niagara Falls or downtown Kingston, but in that region, it's probably very good viewing.
Hmm.
And a lot of people want to see it. It's pretty exciting.
And, well, on a good note, I read from our colleagues at BlogTO that Toronto Public Libraries were giving out glasses, and I'm not sure if it was one day only yesterday or what it was, but I immediately called home, and we are now the proud owner of two pairs of eclipse goggles, courtesy of the Toronto Public Library. So thank you so much.
I think James is on that board, so thank you, James.
I'm not on that board, but I will say that we'll be doing a big viewing up in the Downsview lands, and we'll be giving out viewing glasses for free, care of Northcrest, the big landowner up there. So we will be hoping for clear skies, and we hope people will come up to Downsview to watch.
And what's the viewing in Downsview like? It's partial or what?
Well, you know, I couldn't tell you. I'm hoping for the best possible outcome. Hopefully full. And if it's partial, then we give half their money back, I guess.
Okay. Are you going to watch it, Taylor?
I might. I don't know. I haven't decided yet. Depends on the crowds. You know, if I get in the highway and it's backed up all the way to Toronto, maybe I'll just turn around.
Uh-huh. That's kind of our plan, too. And Paula, are you going to do anything on April the 8th, eclipse-like?
I'm hoping that I'll be able to watch it. I haven't seen one for about 40 years, and it was very moving and exciting when I saw that, Libby. So I'm going to try.
Okay. We're all going to try. On that note, we wrap things up. Thank you so much, Councillor Paula Fletcher, Councillor James Pasternak, and Taylor Scollett.
Thanks, Libby.
All right. Thank you very much,
Libby.
Thank
you.
Okay.
Take care.
Thank you. We'll talk again soon. Right now, we're taking a break. And when we come back, a dispatch from Israel.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Now we have a special perspective on our coverage of the Israel-Hamas war. Fight Back's regular producer, Zeev Hadi, is in Israel on holiday, and I spoke to him about his take on what's happening inside the country.
Everywhere you look, any public space, any park bench, you'll see posters of hostages. And it's one thing is clear is that Israelis have one thing in mind, and that's bringing all of them home.
What I had heard from friends and colleagues is that people in Israel are basically depressed and would feel guilty about having a good time with anything. Is that what you're finding?
Not necessarily. I mean, there is, yes, a general sense of depression. People are sad. Grieving. Everybody I've spoken to is expressing some form of sadness. And look, pretty much everyone I've spoken to knows somebody who was either killed or kidnapped or affected in some traumatic way. Yet what surprised me the most, Libby, is that many people, where I'm at in Tel Aviv at least, are really keen to hit the restaurants up, to go to the pubs, to spend time together. Maybe it's a form of escape, but really, I think it also just shows their sheer determination to live.
And live while you can, and resilience, I guess.
For sure. I mean, that's something that, you know, in speaking to my own family that lives here, they all feel that they want to be able to move forward, even though they've been hit with such trauma.
We had this vote in the House of Commons. It started off as a unilateral recognition of a Palestinian state. It was much watered down. Now the government is trumpeting that they will no longer sell arms to Israel. Not that Canada sells that much. Is there any awareness of Canada and what's happening here in Israel, among your family even?
There is. And as a state, I had the opportunity to ask some people about that here in Israel. And I reached out to I passed by a local business owner in Tel Aviv, and he told me that when he heard this news, his thinking is that under no circumstances would he like to see such a recognition of a state, especially considering what happened in the aftermath of October 7th. He doesn't feel it was just, it's a justified move. And then I happened to speak also to an individual who happens to be Israeli-Canadian. He has lived experience both in Canada and Israel. And he tells me that from his point of view, whatever Ottawa decides on any matters of foreign affairs, especially to do with this conflict, is meaningless. And he says that, sure, those in Israel.
In terms of what's happening inside Israel, we've seen a resurgence of very large anti-government demonstrations, which were ongoing before the October 7th massacre. And all the people I know want Netanyahu gone. But there's no sign of elections happening now. So what's your sense of all of that?
It's 100% true. In fact, it's persistent till today. And I noticed, having walked through the streets in different neighborhoods, there's big posters saying, translated to English, "You are the head, you are responsible." And the general sentiment here is that Bibi should take accountability and should leave.
And in the meantime, he seems to be shoring up his ultra-right-wing, ultra-Orthodox base.
I think that at this point, that while that may be the case, I think that everybody's mind right now is just on getting the hostages back. And there doesn't seem to be any progress on that front.
Well, the talks have restarted in Qatar. Any hope on that front? And we have the head of the Mossad representing Israel. So people are not hopeful, right?
Well, from what I understood is that Netanyahu had limited the mandate of those who are in Qatar speaking on behalf of Israel, negotiating for the return of the hostages. Right now, it kind of feels like the country's in a bit of a state of limbo, Libby, where people are just sort of waiting for what's going to happen next.
Okay, Zeev, thanks a lot for that. And hopefully we'll check in with you again before you return home.
Thank you, Libby. Thanks so much. Bye.
Bye. Shalom. Okay, that was producer Zeev Hadi. We're taking another break. And when we come back, we got numbers. The number of our elders that were sent to nursing homes they did not choose. We'll have that when we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. It's the first time we're seeing numbers on a controversial law the government implemented a little over a year ago. Nearly 300 people in Ontario have been moved from hospitals to long-term care homes not of their choosing. The law can see those patients placed in homes up to 70 kilometres away, or 150 kilometers if they're in northern Ontario. And that being homes that they did not consent to, that they feel their loved ones cannot get to. The law also requires hospitals to charge people $400 a day if they refuse to transfer. Now, this is aimed at moving so-called alternate level of care patients who can be discharged from the hospital but need a long-term care bed and don't yet have one in order to free up hospital space. The government says only a tiny percentage of nursing home patients have been moved this way. And as far as they know, the $400 a day fine has never been imposed. So I'd like to hear from you, especially if you've had a loved one who's been transferred to a home not of the family's choosing. Numbers 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And now I'm joined by NDP health critic Franche Gélina, Chief Executive Officer of the Registered Nurses Association of Ontario, Dr. Doris Greenspoon, and Dr. Samir Sinha, Director of Geriatrics at Mount Sinai and the University Health Network in Toronto. Hello and welcome to you all.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Hi, Libby. Thanks for having us.
Okay, let us begin with Dr. Sinha. So what is your reaction to this number?
Well, it sounds like a small number, but to me it's a massive number because these are nearly 300 individuals who had, in my view, their constitutional rights to be able to consent to where they would live for the rest of their lives not respected. This process, while the government makes it sound like it's an innocent thing that it's not affecting many people, you have to remember there are thousands of other people who are being told, if you don't choose these homes, if you don't do this, we will force you to go to a home not of your choosing, and we will fine you $400 a day. And that's coercion, and that's not how we should be practicing healthcare. I don't think any nurse, any doctor, any social worker wants to be threatening people in a system that, frankly, doesn't have enough home care to allow people to return home and doesn't have enough of the long-term care services we need to allow us to be able to respect people's choices. So I've been very upset about this bill. I don't think it's the right thing to do. Ontario is the only province that I know of that's enacted a policy where we no longer have to respect the patient's right to consent. And that's a line that we should never have crossed and we should never have moved forward with.
Franche Gélina, the argument is they say, okay, so which rights trump which other rights? So on the one hand, you have people who are stuck going to a place they did not choose. But what about all the people who are waiting for acute care, which is best delivered in the hospital, who are having their surgeries postponed and suffering consequences like that, or they're stuck in a hallway in emergency because there are no beds for them? So what about those people?
Well, you cannot take away the right of a frail elderly person to consent to have their medical information share, to consent to move to a home that is not 150 kilometers away, where they stand by themselves wondering, how come nobody comes to see me? How come nobody cares about me? That's because your wife is not able to drive 150 kilometers to go see you. Although she loves you and would like to support you, she can't. The choices that you are giving are false choice. We could invest in home care. We could keep the 90% of the people who are ALC who wants to go back home. We could do this if we had a government who understand that our home care system is broken because they privatized it, and Bayshore makes hundreds of millions of dollars off of not offering quality care. Our hospital, or all of the people that don't have access to primary care, 2.2 million, they also depends on our hospital. This is a crisis of the making of this government and the government before, I would tell you. The choices are not between 300 people being moved away and people having surgery. The crisis is, do we want our healthcare system to be there for people, give them primary care, give them home care, give them mental health? and make sure that your healthcare system works good for all of us?
It's not just money. We know that there is a huge shortage of workers. The government has been, to be fair, recruiting some workers, offering to pay for certain kinds of courses. But in the situation we're in, and previous governments, by the way, also ignored the fact that a lot of healthcare professionals were set to retire. So what is a practical solution to the place that we are in now, Doris?
Thank you, Libby, for asking that question. And I do want to reinforce Francelina's comment and Samir's comments and yours. This is not a new situation. This has been for decades, going back even to Bob Rae when he was premier. Honestly, for decades and decades, all governments of all political stripes. And the shortfall on vision was to really build community care better, to build number one home care in a much stronger way, to build even primary care in a stronger way. The focus has been always hospitals, and now this is the situation. Let me say one thing. Hospitals are not the best place for older persons that
require
nursing home to be. No, they're not. They don't receive sufficient attention. So the choice for these 300 people was to be, quite frankly, not in the best place because it's not a priority care for people that are awaiting ALC. And I would love to see a survey of these 300 people to see their satisfaction of care now compared to before. That's number one. Something very important is not only if you are 70 kilometers away in the north, it's 150. It's not only the 70 kilometers away, it's where you get better care and you will have more satisfaction and better clinical results, less falls, less pressure injuries, better satisfaction with the overall care, better emotional care, et cetera. I would love to see a survey I haven't seen on the 300 people. I'm not agreeing that people should be far away, let me be clear, but I also know that hospitals are not the best place to be. I work at Mount Sinai with Dr. Samir for many, many years, and it's an outstanding place. No, it's not the best place, even the best outstanding. Not every nursing home is the best place. There are good ones and less good ones. So let's see where these 300 people went and how satisfied they are with their care and what their families say.
Let me just give the numbers out again. The numbers 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. We're talking about 300 people, 300 elders who were moved out of hospital and into long-term care homes that they did not choose. And in the past, we have heard from people who have been in that situation. But if you have a loved one in long-term care, I'd like to know what you make of this. Also, again, has this situation come up for you? And as Doris pointed out, it's 75 kilometers in most of the province, but if you're in the north, it's 150. And France, can you tell us, do you have some examples to tell us about where some people in your area ended up? France, are you there?
Sorry, all of the long-term care homes in Northern Ontario are always full at full capacity. But people are still being moved to homes that are not of their choosing. And most of the time in the north, the number one reason to choose is that you will be close to your family, you will be close to your loved one, so that they come and support you and they come and help you. I have hundreds of cases of people whose loved ones have been moved into a long-term care home, not of their choosing. It's far away from their family, and they are not happy. none of them are happy. And it always comes down to the same thing. They want to see their family. They want to see their loved ones. But you're talking roads in Northern Ontario. There is no public transit where I live. There is. You either drive, but if your husband is in a long-term care home and he's 87 years old, there's a good chance you're in your 80, and there's a good chance you're not able to drive 100 kilometers in the middle of the winter to go see him, but he still wants to see you.
Can you give us an example of where people were from and where they ended up, like a specific example?
Oh, absolutely. A couple, one ended up in Pioneer Manor in one long-term care home.
Where is that?
It's
Sudbury.
In Sudbury. And one ended up in Finlandia Koti, which is also within Sudbury, but miles apart. He phoned what was the CCAC home and community care every single day because he wanted to move with his wife. When they finally were able to bring it together, she died that week.
Oh no.
I have cases like this all over my riding. My riding is the seventh biggest riding in Ontario, hundreds of miles apart, and lots of people. They live in one area of Sudbury, but to get to the long-term care where their spouse has been placed is like 75 kilometers away. It's like an hour's drive. When you're in your 80s, I shouldn't say this, some of them are able to drive, most are not. And then the hardship starts.
Okay, I'm thank you for that. I'm going to take a call from Carolyn in Bowmanville. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. This whole situation is very close to home for our family. My son-in-law has an incurable brain disorder.
Sorry.
And he has been given a limited time to live, and he's deteriorating to the point where there has to be home care. He had a seizure a few weeks ago, was put in the hospital. There was no serious damage other than it advanced the deterioration of his brain, which is what he's dealing with. So he's on a list to get into various homes, and there's, of course, a very long list. So they sent him home. He now has three PSWs a day, one in the morning, one in the afternoon, and one in the early evening. Being at home sounds like it's ideal. But if you're at home with only PSWs who come in for supposedly an hour but don't stay that long, and there is no family present because they have to work, you're by yourself. So to mm-hmm. one of your mm-hmm. other guests' point, he would be better off in a long-term care home with the interactions that happen there and a little more concentrated care, shall we say it. It's a horrible situation, regardless of whether it's a couple that split up. In this particular case, my son-in-law has symptoms are a combination of Parkinson's dementia and Lou Gehrig's disease.
Oh, I'm so sorry. It's a horrible situation. So sorry
it's
for your
horrible.
Family.
Thank you. But it's in his case, even if he was sent farther away than we would like, at least we would know until we could get to him. He would have the level of care that he's not getting at home. The PSWs are try hard, or at least some of them do, but it's not the quality of care that we had thought we would get in the first place, because there's a great deal of disorganization within those companies. There are three companies sending PSWs to the home. Each one is different. There's different issues with the staffing, their understanding of the case. They don't seem to do case notes and share them. And so he is at home and without any real company during the day. And it's not a good situation, but it's the best that can be managed.
Carolyn,
right now,
thank you for sharing your story. I'm so sorry, and I wish you and your son-in-law and all the rest of your family all the best. Let's take a call from John in Toronto. Hi, John.
Hi. It's deplorable that they're kicking these people out of the hospitals prematurely and sending them to old age homes that could be like sending them down a slippery slope highway to hell, because some of them, they didn't treat the old people elderly very well, and resulted in them not being fed for dozens of days and never washed them. They made a mess of their...
In the pandemic that happened.
During this scandemic that happened, and then, of course, they want more money. So I think you all should take care of your parents. If you all got brothers and sisters, you all should live with your parents to extend their life if you really love them, instead of sweeping to the side.
Okay, not everybody is able to do that. Thanks for your call. So in the situation, we just heard that, well, home care, but it's not always an ideal situation. And some PSWs are better than others. Some of the companies delivering the service are better than others. So what do we do about this in the situation that we're in, Dr. Sinha?
Thanks, Libby. I think the challenge here is that, I think, as Doris had said earlier, you know, there's been such a focus, I think, by this and other governments around building more hospitals, building more institutions, when we've really lost the opportunity to really build a strong and well-funded and organized home care system. We have to remember that this government has pledged $34 billion to build new long-term care beds, but only $1 billion more to improve home and community care. And so many people end up going into long-term care because we don't have enough home and community care. We don't have enough home and community care. That's the first issue that we need to resolve, and we need to do that as soon as possible. The other issue is, though, we can't take it out on folks, for example, by taking away their rights to consent, because you have to remember, all of these folks have made at least five choices. As Franz is telling you about our constituents or my patients, you know, they make very thoughtful choices about where they'd want to live. Often it's because they need to have language concordant care. I'm a Chinese elder, for example, therefore I'd like to be in a home where I could get care by people who speak my language and serve the food that I like to eat and that. Because those things matter. Being close to your family matters. Having care in the language of your choice matters. And that's why people make certain choices. But when we say, you know what, all these homes have long wait lists, but you know that home over there that nobody's waiting for, that nobody wants to go to, there's a bed there, you're going there, tough luck, and good luck. And I know that we've had lots of articles that have come out from people put in these situations, and it hasn't gone well. And I think this is a problem that we need to say, this is not the way we do it, by stripping people's rights. We need to actually invest in the right forms of care, so that people, you know, can get the right care without having to start taking away their constitutional rights to consent.
Okay, we're over time. Thank you so much, Dr. Samir Sinha, Franchelina, and Dr. Doris Greenspoon. And that is all the time we have for today. Free for All Friday coming up tomorrow. So we will talk then. And if you didn't get through, call tomorrow. Bye-bye.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.